Rabbi Grisman, thank you so much for hosting this and for inviting me. And I hope that you're more awake now than at 2:10 in the morning, my usual time. I feel a little bit more awake than at 2:10. So I hope that's true in general for the chevra. I think we're slowly reaching. Actually, no, we've now exceeded the normal crowd for a 2:10 a.m. program. I think I think so. But it's great to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. And the topic here is a very interesting topic. The issue is the vaccine trials, or more accurately termed, the challenge trials regarding vaccines. And this was a topic that came up in some of the literature I was looking at a few weeks ago, and I wanted an opportunity to speak about it. And thank you for giving me that opportunity. I also see Ilan Metz's computer here, so I want to thank Dr. Gila Metz for sending me articles from the Journal of Infectious Diseases, which helped me get a clear understanding of what these challenge trials are. Now, we have a source sheet, which I'm going to share on the screen in a little bit. I like to see people. That's my preference when speaking, as opposed to having the sheet showing. So as long as I can get away without showing it, I will. But I put in the chat a link so that you can download the sheet for anyone who doesn't already have it. I just resent the link there. One of the fun things about Zoom is that if you sign in and somebody already put something in the chat, you can't see it, which makes sense, but it's a little frustrating. So I just reposted it. In any case, human challenge trials. So there was an article that appeared in the Journal of Infectious Diseases back in April called Human Challenge Studies to Accelerate Coronavirus Vaccine Licensure. And I want to explain a little bit about what this looks like, or what they were proposing in the paper, and a little bit of the opposition to it, the ethical opposition to what they were talking about. I'm not going to be discussing the science behind it, just the ethical issues. And what I want to do is look at how Jewish ethics, Jewish law, look at this issue, because it's a fascinating, fascinating question. So the deal is this. They're looking at numerous vaccine candidates. I'm sure you've been following the news as much or more than I have, so you know. You're talking, I've seen estimates, 90 vaccine candidates, 100 vaccine candidates, using different mechanisms, developed in different ways. Every article must say, I think there's a law somewhere that says every article must say this is much faster than has ever been done in the past. It's usually 10, 15, 20 years, and now we're talking about 12 to 18 months. That 12 to 18 months, by the way, never changes. It's been 2 months since I heard them say that, and it's still saying 12 to 18 months. No one's saying 10 to 16 months now. I'm not sure exactly why that is. But in any case, this is the procedure that researchers Eyal Lipsitch and Smith proposed. First, you would take your candidate vaccine and run initial basic safety trials, as well as dosage findings to determine what kind of dose might be necessary and safe. And then immunogenicity has to be tested. Immunogenicity means you test to see whether the vaccine provokes the desired immune response. So you're just basically testing before you get to the human challenges, before you get to the human subjects, frankly, I think for a lot of this, you're just establishing basic safety and basic efficacy, that this vaccine can work to provoke an immune response and not kill the person you are injecting with it. At that point, you move into the challenge study. You take candidates who are at low risk for complications or mortality as a result of having COVID-19, but who come from a population that has a substantial risk of natural exposure anyway. So you want people who, if they get sick, are at the low end in terms of risk. On the other hand, you also want to take people who likely would have gotten this anyway, or would have been exposed to it anyway. Some of the people in your group are going to receive a vaccine. Some of them are going to receive a placebo. of course, the people who are injecting them have no idea who's who. The subjects have no idea who's who. That's critical. After a period of time elapses, allowing them to develop an immune response, they are then exposed to a dose of virus sufficient to produce a response in them that is not worse than they would have had with a natural exposure out in the community, the reason being for ethical reasons. You don't want to expose them to something that's going to make them sicker than they would have been if they got sick out there in the real world. Now, the way you do it, I'm getting a message saying my audio is breaking up. Can people hear me? I'm getting a lot of head shaking yes. Okay.
We can hear you. It was just breaking up a bit.
Okay. This may be a little bit better. So going back to where we were with this, there is a risk that a vaccine can actually trigger a worse response, make things worse in somebody. So what they would do is actually stagger the groups who are being injected with this, so that you start with one group, you watch them to see if things get worse, and if things don't get worse, then you proceed from there with your other groups. Those who become infected with the disease through this trial have priority for the best care, the best resources, and so on. Now, what you're doing is you're trying to solve the ethical problem of exposing people directly to a disease without any protection, right? Those people who are in your placebo group. You're trying to solve your problem as best you can by taking people who likely would have gotten it anyway, or you project as best you can, people who are least likely to suffer terribly from the disease, and you give them the best possible care. That's your way to try to solve for the fact that you're fundamentally making people ill. That's what you're doing. Now, what's the justification for doing this? What would you say? What's the justification for going through this process, for making infecting people knowingly with a disease? Right. Saving other people, right. I should know, because someone was kind enough to send me a message in the chat, and normally I give a disclaimer at the beginning, so I'm going to give a disclaimer now. I actually prefer that people should answer me like verbally and ask questions out loud rather than posting things in the chat. I find it less distracting. Otherwise, I'm monitoring the chat for comments, and that's a distraction for me. Somebody did note in the chat that if people turn off individual video, it may improve the sound quality. My experience is not that. My experience is that a lot of the sound quality issues are just my computer. But and I like being able to see people. So let's see how this goes. So one justification is you're helping humanity as a whole. Another justification, which is related, is the fact that we do things like this all the time in society. We recruit firefighters. We recruit EMS people even in the middle of a pandemic, right? You know that you're recruiting people and exposing them to harm for the sake of the community. People donate organs, right? There's a level of risk involved there, but we do it. That's one justification. Another justification is consent. They know what's going on. They're being told what the risks are. Media coverage makes it very clear that there's a serious risk associated with any infection with this. So therefore, they know what they're getting into, and it's their decision. And that's another justification. The fact that we use people who are likely to be exposed anyway is another justification. We're taking good care of them is another justification. Well, there was a letter written in response in the Journal of Infectious Diseases that was very, very sharply worded, saying, you know, the fact that we have people volunteer for drug trials elsewhere, which was another of the justifications, that's not a good basis. We shouldn't be doing it at all. Organ donation does not have an analogous risk. Don't bring me proofs from organ donation. They say, and if you're going to tell me we're using subjects who are normally exposed anyway in the course of life, you know, they're living in communities where people get exposed to the virus, well, I will ask you, is it ethical to take people who work in mines and expose them to carcinogens in order to test cancer therapies? after all, you'll help all the people who develop the cancers, and they lurk in a mine, and therefore they're exposed to carcinogens anyway. That was another of the arguments. As far as the argument of, yeah, but you're saving millions and millions of people, the response to that is, utilitarian morality has no place in medicine. The idea that you're going to play a numbers game and say, if you can save X number of people, then it's worth it to do away with these people, is not appropriate in medicine. And then their last point that they raised was, what if you have somebody who is functional, but perhaps mentally ill, and they volunteer for the trial? What do you do if you have somebody who isn't really able to provide proper consent? And then there was a letter they responded with back. It went back and forth, and so the question is, what would Jewish law have to say about this striking ethical question? I should note, before I open the floor, this is not a new question within Judaism. This question came up really, decades ago, when they started doing organ transplant. In the early days of organ transplants, where, as Rav Moshe Feinstein famously said regarding heart transplants, he viewed it as double murder. You were killing the person from whom you took the heart, because they were taking it while the heart was still beating, and you're killing the person who's receiving it because they're not going to live long. And in those days, the question was, remember those days, people really, the person who received it really didn't live long. So the question was, is it appropriate for a Jew to volunteer to be a guinea pig in such an experiment, with the goal being to help humanity? And there the arguments were very strongly against. The arguments were, if other people want to do this, that's their business, but you should not engage in it. So my question now is, regarding these the potential human challenge studies, what would you say? What do you think Judaism would say on this? I open the floor.
Judaism would say, fine. We're looking, if we could save a life, then we would be, that would be beneficial.
Even knowing that you're going to infect people with the disease, people who are getting the placebo are going to be, in very great danger. Mm-hmm. You still think it's worthwhile?
On the level of risk.
Chaim says, level of risk. Okay. I mean, there's a level of risk no matter what you do in this one, a pretty high level of risk. There's a limit to what you can do.
Not for healthy people.
Not for healthy people? I don't know. I mean, and for me, every other week at least, I'm reading reports that say, hey, here's another side effect that we didn't know about, or here's another way in which it's harming people we thought were not really that vulnerable, right? This syndrome that they described in New York that's like Kawasaki syndrome as one example in young people. I don't know that we know enough to really be able to say that there isn't a significant risk. I'm just putting, again, a link in the chat for the source sheet for those who don't have it to be able to download it. I'm going to be sharing it on my screen shortly as well.
So why was Yonah allowed to be thrown overboard?
Right.
In Sefer Yonah?
So Albert asks, why was Yonah allowed to be thrown overboard? In the book of Yonah, he's on the boat. He says to them, throw me overboard to save everybody. So what do you think the distinction is?
I'm not sure there is one. He had an almost certainty that he was going to die by being thrown over. The certainty that somebody's going to die here is much smaller if you choose people properly. Still a possibility, but the possibility is much lower.
So let me ask you a question. If Yonah doesn't go overboard, what happens to him?
Everybody dies.
Exactly. Menachem says everybody would have died if he stayed on the boat, including Yonah. He's not really sacrificing anything.
But Yonah was at fault to start with.
Also true, right? The reason for the storm is Yonah, so he is the one who's endangering everybody. So those are two major distinctions between the cases. Yeah.
Sorry, we also have the situation of a town that's under siege, and they say, give us this one guy, we'll let the rest of the city go, and they threw his head over or something like that, right?
So we will talk about that. You're talking Sheva ben Bichri, and that will come up on the sheet in source number... Where did I put it? 19. It'll be in source number 19. The very fact that I said source number 19 and we're 16 minutes in doesn't bode well, so maybe I should move into the shir. Thank you for that. That reminded me that we should get going. Okay. Yes.
Rabbi, don't we also live in a city, like we live in Toronto, where like 67% people have the virus, and the people that live outside the city, like in North and all the mayors are always complaining of city crawlers coming to their cottages.
Right. So my understanding, and I'm not playing a doctor here, and there are several doctors who I can see on here, is that the rate of infection in the city, at least that we know of, is nowhere near that level. Meaning, you're talking in the 5 to 7% range is the numbers that I've read that we know people have been infected in Toronto. Is that doctors? Anybody want to speak to this?
I thought it was lower than that. Actually, I thought it was closer to 1%, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's certainly not at the 60% level, you know, that we're not seeing. So I'm going to share the source sheet, and we're going to get moving on the substance of this. So it should show up on your screen very shortly. The top of it is just links to where you can find the articles online that I referenced from the Journal of Infectious Disease. And thank you again, Dr. Metz, for sending those my way. The way I want to tackle this is first talk about self-endangerment within Judaism in general, then move into self-endangerment for the sake of benefiting others, and then move into it from the other perspective, which is not the person who's entering the trial, but the perspective of society. Is it all right to actually recruit people for this before getting into the issue of informed consent, which is a thorny issue in its own right? So we have a lot to talk about. First of all, self-endangerment. So it's well established within Judaism that we are not allowed to endanger our lives. We are not the owners of our lives. The Gemara talks about a chovel be'atzmo, somebody who wounds himself is liable. We are not allowed to hurt ourselves. Just the opposite, we have a duty to protect our lives. Because of this, we are taught to violate various laws of Judaism to save a life, including even the laws of Shabbos. No questions asked, you just go ahead and do. This is not only in terms of immediate harm or immediate life and death, it even applies to long-term dangers for danger to one's health, long-term life and death issues. I brought you as an example, source number one, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, the son-in-law of Rav Eliashiv, who quoted the Briska Rav. Say he was dealing with a case of somebody who wanted to fast on Yom Kippur, and the doctor said that fasting now could lead to harm for him because he was ill, not harm right now, but harm years down the line. And the Briska Rav's answer, if you take a look at source number one, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav told a doctor, this is my translation as it is in general on the sheet, that saving a life is not specifically the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. Even where the fast will affect him years later when the disease will recur, and so fasting now will cause him to die early, this is saving a life. He's required to eat. In other words, long-term harm is also considered an immediate threat to life. And I brought you in source number two the position of Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, who says that that applies to sleep apnea. Not all sleep apnea, but sleep apnea where the sense of the doctors is that if it persists, it will damage the person's heart health. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, quoting Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, says, such a patient is considered dangerously ill right now in terms of issues like using a CPAP machine on Shabbos. Parenthetically, just as an aside, my Beit Midrash produced a packet for Shavuos of 10 do-it-yourself shiurim. And the shiur on CPAP machines is one of them that's in it. I believe, if it hasn't already been made available to Rabbi Grisman, it will be made available in the next day or so. Rabbi, do you have it already?
It is. It's coming in a bulletin in the next day or two.
Wonderful. Okay, so the shul will send it out. You can see more about the CPAP issue there. I did note on your sheet in source number three, Rabbi Moshe Heineman disagrees. It says it's not called a cholesh yesh bo sakana, somebody who is immediately dangerously ill, but he does say that it's still a high level of illness right now because of the long-term potential harm. So he's willing to override certain aspects of Shabbos because of it. Take a look on the sheet and you'll see what he said. My point is not the CPAP machine. My point is not sleep apnea. My point is the seriousness with which the sages say we have to watch out for our health, including long-term threats to health. And on that basis, I would have said, there's no way you can volunteer for a challenge trial. How do you even know what the long-term impact is of having COVID-19, even if you get better now? Who knows what the risks are, scarring of lungs or whatever else you want to suggest could be a problem. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we have precedent within Judaism for allowing people to endanger themselves for the sake of personal gain. Example, for the sake of medical gain, right? We have a link in source number 4 where you can find a recording of a class I gave on using medicines that are unproven. As a general rule, all medicine is viewed as risky. Anytime you intervene, you introduce something into the body, you engage in a surgical procedure, you are automatically endangering people. We do it because of potential gain. There's a lot about that. Rav Kook has a piece about that, not for a discussion right now. But as a general rule, we go back to what Chaim Bessin said before, which is we measure risk versus reward for the person who is doing this. So I brought you Rabbi Mordechai Halperin in the journal Asya in source number 5, who says, a patient may introduce himself into danger when the chances of healing are good. We allow this. We need confidence that whatever the procedure is recommended by experts. And here I brought you source number 6 as I scroll down, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the Chida, who says we go with the people who are licensed to practice, licensed by the secular authorities. In source number 7, I noted Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing in Israel in the 20th century, he says, what you're looking for is standard of care, the accepted medical approach for an illness. You are allowed to endanger yourself so long as you're using the standard of care. What do you do? What would one do? Hang on, I'm getting a message about choppy sound. Try standing more still. It's hard for me to stand still. Hold on. It's not about standing still. Good news. Okay, that'll be much better now. It wasn't about standing still. I'll tell you now, in case any of you are in this position when you're doing a Zoom, if you run into that problem where it's giving you a message about your audio not working well, do the test microphone and speaker thing. It actually works very well to dispel things, albeit temporarily. Again, what we're saying is that you are allowed to endanger yourself in order to pursue healing. That is something that you're allowed to do, so long as you take certain precautions. You go with the advice of the certified experts. You go with the standard of care. In the event that there's a dispute between the medical authorities, you look for a clear majority of medical authorities. I brought that for you in source number 8, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, the Shvus Yaakov, who wants to see a 2/3 majority among the doctors. You see it, a recognizable majority, which is double. That's what he wants to see, where there's disagreement. But fundamentally, the point and the reason why I stress this is to show you that, yes, we absolutely have precedent for entering into danger to help yourself. But that's not our case. Our case involves a patient who's perfectly healthy. We're putting that patient into harm's way with an unpredictable illness. So you can't really bring that as evidence or support. Now, you could make the argument that for reasonable non-medical benefit, we also allow people to take risks. The Gemara in Bava Metzia, source number 9, points out something fascinating. The Torah describes a mitzvah. I am required, if I hire somebody to work for me by the day, I am required to pay that person on time. Right? On time, is it that day? Is it before the next morning? I have a requirement to pay that person on time. Chok v'lo yavor. That's the law. And the Torah says, how dare you delay payment? It says, this person is relying on the money you're going to give them. They love who knows say us not show. And for that payment, he puts his life on the line. And the Gemara says on that, in source number 9, it says, this person climbed a ramp to do construction or something, suspended himself from a tree trying to pick the fruit, and endangered himself for his wages. How dare you withhold a person's wages? That's the Gemara's line. Halachic authorities look at that and say, huh, that's really interesting. Who gave this person permission to endanger himself in order to make a living? Who said that was okay? And the answer is clearly, it is okay. You are allowed to put yourself at some level of risk in order to pursue a livelihood. And the truth of the matter is, we don't close our workplaces every time there's a disease around the community, right? You say, well, there are gradations. COVID-19 is not the same thing as, you know, fill in the blank, other disease you want to mention. And that's certainly true. Nonetheless, the point that we make here is you are allowed to take risks even where it's not for the sake of your own medical treatment. And here I quote you an article that just came out last week, which I found very helpful. A former Rebbe of mine, Rabbi Meir Twersky, wrote an article called Lech Ami Bo Bacha Darecha. And I brought you an excerpt here in source number 10. He says, his article is basically an argument against opening minyanim too soon. That's his point. And he says, it is true and correct that one may distinguish between a temporary threat and a threat which has taken root and created a new reality. Those who can read the Hebrew, you'll be amused, in parentheses on the first line. New normal. That needed to appear in the Hebrew. He says, it's true and correct that you would distinguish between a temporary threat and a threat which has taken root and created a new reality. Where the threat is temporary, perhaps one is required to wait and hide, quote, until the wrath passes. But where the threat has become embedded in the fabric of life, along the lines of the dangers of childbirth, for example, it is not possible to wait for it to pass. One definitely must live life while dealing with the threat. So, in other words, what Rav Twersky is saying there is a person should not feel that for all risks, for all potential harm, we have to run away and hide in our rooms, you know, till it's over. There are things which become part of the fabric of life. And for all I know, COVID-19 may become that at some point, if the vaccines don't work, certainly. We could end up in that situation. But since right now we're in a position in which we are able to avoid exposure, and we don't know, but we think that this may well pass, our obligation at this stage is to stay away from exposure. So the fact that you're allowed to take risks in order to earn a living is because if you're going to wait for those risks to pass, you won't be able to make a living. That's not the same thing here. People don't need to be exposed to a vaccine candidate or not even vaccine candidate. People don't need to be exposed to the virus itself with a placebo. That's not something that they had to have happen. So if I stopped here, if we stopped at this stage, I would have said, there's no way that somebody would be allowed to participate in a challenge trial. You could end up with a placebo and exposed to the virus. Even if you have the vaccine may not work. Right? Everybody knows that these vaccines are being done very, very quickly in ways that are unprecedented. How do you know it's going to work? But that's not the whole argument, because it's only 8:30, and Rabbi Grisman told me I have till 8:45, and I can take a few minutes for questions after that, so unless I misunderstood. We're good? Okay. So I think we do have precedent in Judaism for viewing self-endangerment for the sake of others differently. Self-endangerment for the sake of others is not weighed in the same way as self-endangerment for the sake of my own medical gain or my own financial gain and the like. And I'm going to go back to the sheet now. I just wanted a chance to see people. So here we go. She's going to come back to your screen with source number 11. First of all, self-endangerment is sometimes justified in order to save particular people who are important to the community. So I brought you here, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, in a classic responsum dealing with the issue of prisoner exchanges for the sake of freeing IDF soldiers. Right? You remember the Gilad Shalit case and the many that preceded it. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi argued that there's a justification to paying a very high price, including the dangerous one of freeing terrorists, because of the importance of the morale of soldiers in the IDF. As he writes, when a soldier knows that should he fall captive, the entire state of Israel would stand behind him to free him, he will risk his life in battle without fear. He needs to know that we're willing to do this on his behalf. So therefore, you're allowed to risk the community in order to save this soldier. The same thing comes up in discussions about using resources for healthcare workers. If healthcare workers who become ill aren't going to be treated immediately and well, then there's a very severe risk that you undermine their willingness to work for the community at all. Another example of this, a classic story in source number 12 from the Talmud Yerushalmi, from the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Isi, a leading sage, was captured by somebody. We don't know who they are. Rabbi Yonatan said, let the corpse be wrapped in its sheet. He said, forget it, nothing you can do about it. The sage Reish Lakish said, I'm going to go get him. I'm going to kill or I will be killed. I'll go save him by force. And then he went and negotiated and got him back. But it sounded good to say, I'll kill or be killed. It's certainly a more rousing thing than I will negotiate. But he manages to get him back, but he's endangering himself in order to do so. What's his justification? There's a great deal of discussion on this point, but one of the justifications that's offered is that Rabbi Isi was somebody of great value to the community, and therefore one would be entitled to endanger himself in order to save someone who is of that value to the community. So we have precedent for saying one may endanger oneself in order to save people who will help the community, and then let's go stronger than that. Because it's not just about saving people who are of high value to the community. It's about saving the community itself. Dr. Kirshen, earlier, mentioned the case of Yonah. Okay, the case where Yonah is willing to be thrown overboard. And as I said, I think there are differences in the Yonah case. I wouldn't go with the Yonah case as my basis. However, there's another case in Tanakh involving somebody who endangers, I'll give away the gender, endangers her life in order to be able to save the rest of the community. And that is, of course, someone get off of mute and answer. What?
Yael.
Oh, that's interesting. Esther. Esther. Right, Yael presumably is in less danger because the guy she's killing is sleeping. If it goes wrong, then yes. But there's risk to her family, reprisal. You can make an argument for Yael also. But certainly Esther is the prime example of somebody who is willing to endanger herself for the sake of saving everybody else. We have precedent for it. And there's a lot of discussion as to how this works and how we know this to be true. I'm going to go back to the source sheet again. I did put the link to it in the chat again, so if anybody wants to download it, you can get it from there. But in source number 13, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli made the point that there is precedent for this in the right of the leaders of the Jewish people to declare war on an enemy. In source number 13, Rabbi Yisraeli, who was a leading rabbi in Israel in the middle of the 20th century, says, it appears to me that one may learn the basis for this from discretionary war, which is for profit, or to expand the control of Israelite reign, or for the sake of the economy. And for this, one may endanger individuals. He says the king is allowed to take people to war, even where it's not a war of defense. And he says that which people commonly say, that war is different, it has special legal status, that has no basis. Why not learn from war as a precedent? And when people say that war has special legal status because it's governed by the Sanhedrin, he says, nah, that's incorrect. Is the Sanhedrin empowered to permit biblical prohibitions? Meaning if the law really were, you're not allowed to endanger yourself for everybody, the Sanhedrin couldn't override that. One must say the basis is that anything related to the welfare of the community or removal from harm is called life-saving. For anything involving the welfare of the community has some relationship to life-saving. That's the position of Rabbi Yisraeli. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach went even further in this regard. In source number 14, I saw this in a piece by Rav Asher Weiss. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said something remarkable in source number 14. He says, my translation here, in a discretionary war, which is just for profit, even the king cannot take the nation to war without a court of 71. You need the Sanhedrin. But he says, for a mitzvah war, including a war of self-defense, when the community is pursued by bears and lions, I don't think he really means bears and lions, nonetheless, when the community is pursued by bears and lions, and they need to fight them and chase them out, perhaps, aside from the fact that this is considered life-saving, and there's a mitzvah of each person to desecrate Shabbos and the like to save lives, perhaps it is also considered a mitzvah war. Although we lack a king or a court, he says, you know, in our day, we don't have a court of 71, and therefore we're not able to take the nation out to war as they once did. Nonetheless, he says, still, the town council could compel and endanger the lives of individuals as with war, even where an individual would not be obligated to save lives. And if we are correct in this, then perhaps war against illnesses which lie in wait for people as well would be like a mitzvah war. It's a very interesting argument. I'm going to pause the sharing here so we can talk this through. The Rabbi Yisraeli's point was to say that just like the king can, through the Sanhedrin, take the nation into war for a discretionary war, because this is for the good of the nation, and therefore you can expect individual soldiers to endanger themselves. That's Rabbi Yisraeli's point. So too, people should be expected to endanger themselves for the community in general. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach goes even further. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, you don't need all the trappings of what was done historically when going to war. The fundamental point, as far as Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is concerned, is that if there is a military threat or a medical threat to the community, that warrants and it licenses the leaders of the community to, yes, endanger people as individuals in order to save the community. That's the position that that he takes. And I'm going to come back to the source so I can read you the rest of what he has here. He says, perhaps a war against illnesses which lie in wait for people as well would be like a mitzvah war, and if we would merit that all would be done to combat it according to the Torah, perhaps a court would see the need to test medicines as a mitzvah war of saving lives. Therefore, in our day, even though it is not done according to Torah, meaning rabbis aren't the ones running the challenge trials, still, since it is done via great experts with great care, logically, there is no prohibition against volunteering for this. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach made the argument that this is like defending the community in war, and therefore it is justified for somebody to volunteer. He says if a rabbinical court were running this, they could even make the argument they could coerce people. Without them, okay, so people can volunteer. Rav Asher Weiss brought this idea in a recent response, in which I brought you in source number 15. As long as it benefits the community, it is appropriate for a group of people whose heart moves them to volunteer for roles involving some danger. He points to a very interesting note. The halacha in Shulchan Aruch, the law, that if you are a judge on a rabbinical court and the defendant, or not the defendant, but one of the litigants threatens the judge is not allowed to walk away and say, I am not going to hear this case, I'm scared of the litigant. The judge is obligated to hear the case. Why? He's exposing himself and potentially his family even to harm. Nonetheless, there are positions that are needed in a community, and they are more important than the individual. And I think that's really the key point. The community is considered to be of greater worth than the individuals that make it up, and therefore, yes, one is able to volunteer for the danger involved in such a situation. And I brought you Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, who said something like this. That's who I'm drawing on with this idea of the community being of greater value. In number 17, the community and the collective are not only a collection of individuals, but an independent entity of its own nature, with its own rules, with the community's collective needs, sometimes even at the expense of the individual. And even though an individual is not nullified opposite the community, Still, the community must make a special calculation of its own in different circumstances. And so what I come out with at this stage in our conversation is that despite all of the rules we saw against endangering oneself and even against endangering one's long-term health, and despite the fact that we said you have to be very careful even when you endanger yourself for the sake of your own medical gain, nonetheless, there is precedent in Judaism to endanger oneself for the sake of saving people who are of great value to the community, and of saving large numbers of people. And this is what we call Hatzala Dirabim, saving the multitudes. That's that I think is what underlies Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and their positions. Now, there's another piece of this. I said to you in the beginning, I wanted to discuss this not only from the perspective of the volunteer, but from the perspective of the community. Are you allowed to coerce people to endanger themselves? And the answer, I think, is clearly no. Rav Shlomo Zalman entertains the possibility that a rabbinical court might have some kind of authority, but otherwise he's not interested in coercion. Rav Asher Weiss is also not interested in coercing. Why not? After all, isn't the logic of sacrificing the individual for the sake of everybody a strong logic? So I think, yes, but there is a responsum which I brought you on the source sheet, but I'll mention it outside in the interest of time, in which the Radbaz, Rabbi David ben Shlomo ibn Avi Zimra, was asked the following question. The government, it's a question that it predated him. The Ricanti dealt with it before him. It's a question that went on a lot in the Middle Ages, hopefully more academically than practically. The government grabs somebody, some Jewish fellow, and says, we're going to execute him. Somebody else comes along and says, no, don't kill him. And the government says, okay, fine. If you let us cut off a body part of yours, then we won't kill him. We're not going to kill you. Just lose a body part. That's all. Is this person obligated to lose the body part to save somebody else's life? And the Radbaz says, no. He says, there is no such obligation. He gives numerous reasons, including, it's gross. He says, the ways of the Torah are pleasant. You can't tell me the Torah would require that somebody suffer maiming in order to save somebody else's life. That's an interesting perspective. It's just something that the Torah wouldn't require, but there's support for it. And this goes back to the case that Menachem mentioned back, half an hour ago, or whenever it was. So I'm going to share it again on the screen. This is famous source number 19, the Talmud Yerushalmi. We have learned, groups of people were traveling on the road. They encountered non-Jews who said, give us one of yours and we'll kill him, or we'll kill all of you. They say, turn over one guy, or we kill everybody. Even if all of them will be killed, they may not surrender a single life. If the attackers designated one, like Sheva ben Bichri, that's that story that Menachem mentioned in which there was a Jew who was... not Jew, there was a person in a city who had rebelled against David, and then he's turned over to save everybody else in the city. In a case like that, they surrender him and are not killed. So here we say, and I'm not going through the Sheva ben Bichri discussion of that follows in the ensuing lines. It's not germane for us right now. The point here is this. We say that if a specific person is requested, you can turn him over. If they don't request a specific person, you're not able to turn him over. If it's a specific person, you're allowed to, because he's going to die anyway. If you don't turn him over, everybody's dead. But otherwise, you're not allowed to choose who it is that is going to perish. That's not for you to do. So what you're seeing here is we don't grab somebody and turn him over for the sake of the community. That's the point. Now, I see your hand, Dr. Nussbaum. But what I want to do is just make sure to highlight a couple of things that become relevant with this discussion. I see it's already 8:46. Rabbi, forgive me 3 more minutes, and then I'll take the questions. I apologize. I usually don't go over, but I did in this case because we ate up a few minutes in the beginning. So maybe that's my justification. But here's the deal. You're telling me that we don't coerce. And indeed, all the sources on this, secular sources, Jewish sources, demand informed consent. Consent from a secular position makes a lot of sense, right? You don't coerce people. The patient has to know what's going to happen and what the risks will be. From a halachic position as well, it makes sense. If we're not going to coerce people, we should we need informed consent. But the thing you have to keep in mind is that informed consent is not so simple. And I brought you a few sources to support the fact that it's not so simple, but I'm going to say them outside. Those who downloaded the source sheet from the link, then you have it in front of you. Number one, patients are surrounded by factors that make it unlikely that their decision could be considered unbiased. Meaning, even in a case where that we're talking about, where they get all the literature in advance and they have time to make their decision, nonetheless, there are, as the writer of this article, Dr. Christopher Myers, the one in source number 20, says, there are power asymmetries, there's physician bias, there's family conflict, there are pressures, there are all sorts of reasons why people make decisions that are not unbiased decisions. It's hard to have full comprehension, full confidence, and really do this properly. That's number one. Number two, anytime a doctor presents an opinion, that creates what's called diagnosis bias. It's a bias where the patient sees that as the default automatically. If a doctor is coming to me and offering this, my default is that's good unless I can find a reason not to. That's a second problem. And then the third problem is, and this is sort of related to the second one, patients tend to assume that the medical establishment is there to take care of them. It's an assumption that we make. I hope it's an assumption that we're going to make for a very long time to come. Generally, our assumption is medical professionals are there to protect our lives. It can't be they would do something which would hurt me. So here you have somebody who is approached to say, well, would you be willing to volunteer for this? He thinks it can't be that bad or they wouldn't be willing to do it. Well, I don't know. I mean, we're willing to inject you with a placebo and then expose you to COVID-19. What do you think? I know COVID-19 is the name of the disease, not the virus. Forgive me. But the reality is that people make that assumption. And the last source that I brought you isn't the medical source. It's a legal source from the Law Society of Ontario, which talks about a case in which a lawyer is facing a self-represented litigant on the other side. And there's fear that the self-represented litigant just assumes everybody here must really be, you know, on the up and up and they want to help me and make sure that I'm taken care of. The lawyer on the other side has to be really clear to make sure that the unrepresented person does not think that the lawyer is somehow looking out for him. The same thing is true here. People are going to assume the doctor's looking out for me. So I think informed consent is not so easy to accomplish here. But just to sum up what we've said, and then I'll take questions. We highlighted first the articles from the Journal of Infectious Diseases about this potential challenge trial. By the way, I mean, we've all read the results from the Moderna trial. I don't know what the protocols were that they used, whether they used this system or a different one. I want to be very, very clear. I'm just talking about the protocol that was in the journal articles that I presented in the beginning. The Torah says risky activity is prohibited. You're not allowed to endanger yourself. Yes, you're allowed to endanger yourself for medical gain. That's true, but we measure risk versus reward very carefully. Yes, you're allowed to endanger yourself for non-medical gain, like to make a living. However, we distinguish, as Rabbi Twersky notes, between a risk that's built into society and life and a risk that could pass and we could actually avoid. Based on that, I would have said, no, you're not allowed to volunteer for this. However, we have precedent for endangering ourselves either for the sake of people who are of high value to the community, like the IDF soldier, like the scholar in the passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, like the healthcare professional who's taking care of people in a pandemic. And we have precedent, like Esther, for endangering ourselves to save large numbers of people, Hatzalah Derabim, as seen in the case of war as a paradigm, as seen in the case of judges dealing with dangerous litigants, as seen in the case of police officers and firefighters. This is indeed what we do. However, we won't coerce people, and therefore we require informed consent, But informed consent is really hard to actually get. And that's what, I think, a key part of the difficulty here. So I thank you so much, Rabbi Grisman. It is always such a pleasure to work with you and with Zichron. And I very much look forward to the opportunity, God willing, to daven with you in person at some point and share Torah together live. But yeah, this was a lot more fun than 2:10 in the morning, I do have to say.
First off, does anyone have any questions?
Yes.
If we were conservative...